On this week's episode of Cultivating Her Space,
we keep Black children alive against a world and institutions that want them annihilated. That is Black feminism. When we nurture new generations at our churches, at our organizations, at our jobs, in our communities, in our households, that is Black feminism. Our choice to live and to live freely and away from the white gaze and to be fully in our bodies and to say, no, you don't get to take all of this. This is for me. That is Black feminism.
Today's episode is sure to provide you with motivation, inspiration, or a fresh perspective. If you have any aha moments or appreciate anything from this episode, please leave us a review to let us know we're on the right track. Also, we release episodes every Friday, so be sure to subscribe on iTunes and visit cultivatingherspace.com to access our exclusive after show and other bonus content from the Patreon tab.
Welcome to Cultivating Her Space, a podcast dedicated to uplifting women like you.
We're your hosts,
Dr. Dominique Broussard, a college professor and psychologist,
and Terry Lomax, a techie and motivational speaker. In a world where Black women are often misrepresented and misunderstood, please join us as we initiate authentic conversations on everything from fibroids to fake friends and create a safe space where Black women can just be.
Hey lady, it's Dr. Dom here from the Cultivating Her Space podcast. Are you currently a resident of the state of California and contemplating starting your therapy journey? Well, if so, please reach out to me at drdominiquebroussard.com. That's drdominiquebroussard.com to schedule a free 15-minute consultation. I look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, lady, we have a very special guest in Cultivating Her Space today. I'm just going to jump right into the bio because we have such a juicy conversation coming up just for you. So let's jump on in. Jen M. Jackson, they, them, is a queer, androgynous Black woman, an abolitionist, a lover of all Black people, and an assistant professor at Syracuse University in the Department of Political Science. They are the author of the book Black Women Taught Us from Penguin Random House and the book Policing Blackness. Jackson was a longtime columnist at Teen Vogue, penning articles on Blackness, intersectionality, racism, politics, and culture in the United States. They have also been published at Al Jazeera, Washington Post, Marie Claire, Ebony Magazine, The Root, and the list goes on and on, okay? We got a heavy hitter in here today, y'all.
Academically,
Jackson's research is in Black politics with a focus on racial threat and trauma, gender and sexuality, Black politics and feminisms, and social movements. Jackson received their doctoral degree in political science at the University of Chicago in 2019. They are a native of Oakland, California, and will always represent their city.
That's
Bay
right.
Area.
That's absolutely
hey.
Right. Hey.
Welcome to the podcast, Jen. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited about this. This is a long time coming. I'm ready for this.
Yes.
Yes. We're so excited. Yes. Okay. So our quote of the day. Now, we had a different quote, but in a last minute change, because we follow you on Twitter. At the time of this recording, our quote of the day is literally your most recent tweet.
Oh.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Okay.
Yes.
Our quote of the day. One of the most important lessons I learned from reading Toni Morrison is that there is no level of bending or acquiescing to whiteness that will ever overcome white supremacy and anti-Blackness. Our performance of goodness won't ever earn inclusion or respect. Now, I'm going to say that one more time for the people in the back to make sure that they heard this. One of the most important lessons I learned from reading Toni Morrison is that there is no level of bending or acquiescing to whiteness that will ever overcome white supremacy and anti-blackness. Our performance of goodness won't ever earn inclusion or respect.
That's right.
Ooh. Ooh.
That's right.
Dr. Jen coming in hard from the beginning.
I be thinking, y'all, it's hard up here. It's a lot, so much happening in my head all the time. I have to put it on the internet.
And the internet needs it. They need it. So, Dr. Jen, when you put this tweet out there, just a few moments ago, literally, the day after Toni Morrison's birthday, what was coming up for you? Give us some context.
Yeah, I've been sitting with Toni Morrison and thinking about her birthday and thinking about Audre Lorde. And I found out that yesterday was also Toussaint Louverture's birthday as well. And, you know, I'm a Virgo. We are not typically compatible with Aquarius, but this Aquarius season been hit a little bit different. I've just really been very reflective. And in thinking about Toni, I've been thinking about her mostly because folks don't associate her as explicitly with Black feminism, with the politics of being Black in America. But she gave us so much rich theory, right? She not only wrote about it in her work, but also she embodied it in the ways that she moved in the publishing industry. She moved in a state of radical refusal with respect to whiteness. Folks would sit directly in her face and ask her why she wouldn't write about white folk. And she looked at them and like, why are you asking me these questions, right? I think a lot about, I tell people this all the time about when Oprah Winfrey called Toni Morrison on the phone. And the first thing Toni Morrison said was, how did you get my phone number? She said, how did you get my phone number? I love this about her because for her, she said, I have privacy, I have boundaries, and I know that you are Oprah Winfrey, but I still don't want nobody calling my house. I just love her radical refusal. You know, so I've been sitting with her spirit these last 2 days, and that's where the tweet came from because I really think that folks don't really pay that much attention to how she modeled a refusal to engage in things that she just wasn't going to be about, you know?
Hey, lady, it's Terry here. Dom and I want to take a moment to thank you for choosing to listen to our podcast. We love you for real, and we want to give you a chance to learn more about what's important to us. So tell us what you think about this.
Imagine a world where you have a chance to get featured on the Cultivating Her Space podcast and share your business, brand, or perspective with millions around the globe. Imagine joining our monthly virtual video check-ins where you can connect with like-minded Black women like you and share your ideas and episode suggestions with Terry and I. Now I want you to imagine a world where you're in the exclusive Cultivating Her Space Sanctuary Slack channel, and throughout your day and week, you are conversing with us about what's happening in your life and sharing funny gifts and your personal wins. How does that sound?
Hopefully this is up your alley, lady, because we are taking things to the next level this year and we're doubling down on investing in our community. That means you.
Yay!
We want to meet you, connect with you, and create communities of genuine women who love on Black women and push our culture and movement forward. We launched this podcast in 2019, and to date, we have not missed a week. We've been great stewards of our platform, all while working full-time and navigating our own ups and downs. We release fresh new content every single Friday, like clockwork, and we have hundreds of valuable episodes and workshops that can really help you uplevel your life. So if you love our mission or you've gotten value from us, we invite you to give back and help us push this community effort forward. Visit herspacepodcast.com and click Patreon. You can learn more about our goals and exclusive offerings on Patreon, and we highly, highly encourage you to join the Sister Frontier so that you can get some one-on-one time with us. We also have an option for you to donate on a one-time basis if that meets your needs. Again, herspacepodcast.com, and you can click that link that says Patreon. All right, lady, we'll hop right back into the conversation.
I love that so much. And when you said that, Jen, it makes me think about how, you know, okay, I feel like I'm going to go off on a tangent, but I promise you I'm going to bring us back.
Yeah.
But just how sometimes when people speak up, when they have clear boundaries, when they don't submit to the status quo, they're seen as difficult or mean.
Right.
But when you say that, I'm like, no, that's a powerful display of you having boundaries, and we should stand on business. We should stand on
yes,
that.
Yes, we should.
And it's something, okay, and it's something I'm still working on, but I admire that so much from what you just, you know, that story that you just shared. So thank you so much for that. We're going to dig into the conversation, but first, we have to learn about your origin story. So please tell us, how did you become the Dr. Jen M. Jackson that we see today?
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I always talk about the reason why Oakland is in my bio is because I always tell folk I will always be a little Black girl from Oakland. That's where I'm from. Oakland made me. My people are from Oakland and they are still there, you know, so it's in my DNA. And I think people who are familiar with Oakland folks know what that means, right? We move a certain type of way. it's just who we are. And my origin story in terms of who I am today is, you know, it's a bit, I think, surprising. I started off as an engineering major at the University of Southern California. Yeah, I was, as a young girl, you know, I was a very queer child, I'm 6'4" tall, and I've been this height since I was 12. So I've always stood out. Right. Yes. That's the reaction I get from everybody. So I've always stood out, and I thought I was going to go to college for playing basketball or, you know, something athletic. But I have a heart condition, which I was diagnosed with at 13. So that was not in the cards for me, you know? And so I luckily was interested in academics. I love math. I love physics. And so I went to USC on mostly just academics alone. And being a poor kid, first generation, my mom and my dad had no idea how to navigate any of that. They didn't even know what this place was, USC. Most people in my family was like, you going where? South Carolina? UCLA? It's another school in LA. You know, it was the whole thing. So, you know, when I got there, I was very much alone. You know, I couldn't go home and ask folks about it and get their advice. They had no idea. And I didn't have a lot of people there. And I had encountered whiteness, you know, really for the first time. I grew up in the blackest part of Oakland. You know, I grew up in East Oakland. I didn't grow up in the hills. I wasn't around white folk generally. And, you know, people were using racial slurs with me. And I was like, oh, you calling me a name? Oh, we just call people out their name? We fight where I'm from. So I'm like, I don't know what's happening here, you know? And it was very jarring, you know? So the college experience, being in LA and dealing with that superficial culture and encountering what I thought was, you know, for the first time, oh, this is misogyny. Oh, this is racism. Oh, these are the things that people have told me about. Wow, I never had to deal with this before, you know? And it's not to say that growing up in Oakland, I didn't encounter these things, right? They were different, right? The texture was different. I knew what it was like to be followed around a store by a security guard. I had been arrested by police. I knew police very intimately, but I didn't understand the interpersonal violence of I'm standing on a corner and there's just some white guy on a skateboard who's mad that I'm Black in public. Never experienced that before. So I got through college. I went to Disneyland in Orange County, California, and was the only Black girl with a degree and did incredible work and just really started changing things. But didn't understand that I was being exploited for my labor. I didn't understand that I wasn't being paid appropriately, that I wasn't getting promotions when I was supposed to get them. But I felt so miserable. I would be at work and people would say awful racist things to me about my hairstyles. Oh, Jen, this is my favorite of your hairs, in the middle of a board meeting. It's 25 people in the room and I'm like, why is everybody looking at my hair? You know, I had people touching me without my permission, right? Because they wanted to feel the texture of my hair. People saying, oh, you know, Africans like you, they had to work in the back in my day because of their corn rolls. And they were two strand twists. They wasn't even cornrows. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just all types of, you know, layers of aggression, right? So that's the point where I was at work and I would be sobbing, crying. Like, I'd be in the bathroom crying. I would come to the office, I'd be in the parking lot in my car. Before I could even get out of my car, I would just be crying. And I called my mother and I was like, Mom, my mom's a voracious reader. She, growing up, she had books on books on books on books. Every time I had said anything, she said, go check the encyclopedia. So I said, Mom, I need answers. I'm struggling. How do I do this? What were all those books I used to read? Because I had read Alice Walker at the foot of my mother's bed. I had read Terry McMillan at the foot of my mother's bed. And I said, please remind me of these texts. And she told me, and I wrote them down on a sticky note, and I ran to Borders Books. And again, in Orange County, the whitest county in California, the most racist county in California. And although I saw the books I was looking for, but I saw Melissa Harris Perry's book, Sister Citizen, and it was staring directly at me. And I was like, what is that? What is this book? I have to see what's in this book. It had this Black woman with this flag on her head, and it was ominous looking. And I opened this book, and Melissa starts writing about the Sapphire, you know, the angry Black woman, the Jezebel, the hypersex Black woman, the Mammy, the asexual caretaker Black woman. And I'm crying into the book at the store. I'm like, oh my God, what is happening to me, you know? And I realized she started talking about this thing called the crooked room. And she said that the crooked room is this phenomenon where we are struggling to stand upright. And we're actually standing upright, but the room is crooked, right? The room is all these stereotypes and these expectations about us and the ways that they want our bodies to fit into these categories that we don't need to fit into, but they force us to for our survival. So I'm, you know, crying into the book. And I said, this is it. This is what I'm experiencing. This is what I feel when I'm going into work. This is why I'm sitting in my bathroom at work crying just to get through the day, because I'm being forced into this crooked room. And I took that book and I started reading everything else that I could find in that book. And the next thing I read was Bell Hooks, Feminism is for Everybody. Then the next thing I read was Audre Lorde, The Master's Tools, We'll Never Dismantle the Master's House. And then I read Kathy Cohen's work. And Kathy Cohen is a political scientist at the University of Chicago. And I learned that both Melissa Harris Perry and Kathy Cohen were working at the University of Chicago as political scientists. And I said, well, maybe I should be a political scientist. So, Virgo. So I was like, well, let me just check in on this. And I essentially shifted the whole arc of my life. I moved away from engineering. I went at night. I was pregnant with my second child. I went to school at night and got a master's in political science at a local university, Cal State Fullerton University. And over the next 3 to 4 years, I planned an exit from corporate, a permanent exit from corporate America. I went to the University of Chicago. I studied with Kathy Cohen. She was my dissertation chair. And now she's one of my closest colleagues and comrades. She blurbed the book. So that's how you got me. I read Black feminist literature, and that's how I became a Black feminist.
Oof. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Right? I'm like, Donna, where do we go from here?
I know. Oh my gosh. So many questions. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Black feminism. For those who are listening that aren't familiar with what the term means, because my guess is when you give us the definition, there will be a lot of listeners who will say, oh, that is me, but aren't putting that name to it. What is Black feminism?
Yeah. So, you know, feminism, one of the most helpful definitions I've ever heard of it is the idea that non-men are humans. That's what feminism is. And unfortunately, because feminism was mainstreamed and co-opted by white women in these various waves. So we have a first wave of feminism that is focused on, you know, white women's orientation to their husbands and how they belong in marriages and the kind of pushing back against that. That's at the kind of turn of the 20th century. But then we get to the 1960s and there's another wave of white women's, you know, feminism, where it's in the civil rights era. They're thinking about labor justice and, you know, the role of white women outside of the home, you know, voting rights and things like that. We move into the 70s and 80s and we see another third, and some people say a fourth wave, you know, we're focused on reproductive justice and how to name ourselves and sexual rights. And that's mainstream feminism. But Black feminism, I usually locate in 1892 with Anna Julia Cooper, who writes the book A Voice from the South. Ida B. Wells was also writing in 1892. She wrote Southern Whores about lynch law in the South. And these two women together are telling us gendered stories about Blackness in the United States. And when we take away these waves from white feminism and we think about what Black women were doing, Black women like Ida B. Wells, Mary Church Terrell, Zora Neale Hurston, Anna Julia Cooper, all the folks I include in the book, Shirley Chisholm, Fannie Lou Hamer, Frances Beale, you know, people who are telling these stories, shoot, Mamie Till, right? These are people who are thinking about the orientation of both Blackness to class and gender. So Black feminism is just that, right? The understanding that folks exist at these multiple margins simultaneously. And because we do, that means we're oriented to power in unique ways, right? That's why we have the term intersectionality. When we look at what the institutions that we are associated with are supposed to do for us, right? When we go to the Social Security Agency or a local hospital, for example, and the ways that they don't even know how to care for people's bodies when they can't see them as legible. That's what Black feminism is asking us to grapple with. So really, it's just thinking that folks who exist at these multiple margins deserve access to life, to justice, that those who are the most vulnerable among us, especially Black trans women, deserve to live beyond the age of 35, right? Deserve to have a full life where they're unbothered and not harassed and molested by strangers on the street. That's what Black feminism is. It's not that scary. People think it's so scary. It's not.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for breaking it down for us. And I'd love for you, I feel like we probably know the answers to this, but I'd love for you as a brilliant, you know, intellectual to break this down for us. But when you think about why Black women have been positioned to the back of the feminist movement, can you talk about why, but also the ways in which we have been positioned to the back or not prioritized?
Yeah, I mean, this is really important, I think. And I was just teaching my young people about this today. We were reading Ida B. Wells just this week. And unfortunately, we know that this, if we want to go back to the era of enslavement, right? We know that for Black women who were enslaved, their experiences were very unique compared to other enslaved folk and to other free women, right? People always neglect to think about the role of the slave mistress in the slave household, right? The slave mistress was so critical to maintaining the racial order of the slave household. And those roles didn't change once slavery ended. So when we think in the post-Reconstruction era, when we move into the era of thinking about voting rights, so voting rights for white women happened in 1920. But when we think about voting rights for Black folks writ large, that was 1965. So part of the reason why Black women are kind of pushed to the back is because many white women in that moment are still very racist. They don't see Black women as their equals, even as Black women are fighting for them to be enfranchised with the vote. The same thing goes for Black women who are fighting alongside Black men. There are many Black men who still don't see these Black women as equals. Instead, they believe, you know, they always say behind every strong Black man is a strong Black woman. And these Black women are saying, well, I got to stand behind you, right? And what we find is that it repeatedly where these charismatic Black male leaders are, there are so many Black women who are scaffolding and quilting these movements, but who are asked to step back, right? To wait their turn. So what ends up happening is in the 1970s, 1977, 1976, the Combahee River Collective comes out and says, we're not waiting no more. We're going to advocate for ourselves. And people didn't like that. The white women didn't like that. And the Black men didn't like that. So it always ends up being this kind of antagonistic relationship where folks feel like if you are centering the most vulnerable, who happen to be the Black trans women, Black queer women, when you center the most vulnerable, they feel, because of scarcity models, capitalism teaches us this awful way of thinking, right? That if you advocate for these groups, there's not enough left over for everybody else. And unfortunately, when white women and Black men advocate for just themselves, they typically leave Black women completely out alone.
Oh, all right. We getting an education over here. And as we are continuing, like, under getting the understanding, oftentimes when we talk about feminism and Black feminism, we also hear the word womanism.
Oh.
So can you tell us the difference between womanism, feminism, Black feminism?
Well, it's so funny. I just got this question the other day on my book tour. So womanism in the 60s and 70s, primarily because it's a reaction to mainstream white feminism that has kind of overtaken what feminism is. And because there's this deep antagonism from Black men toward Black feminism. So because there becomes this kind of aggression toward Black feminists, some feminists move away from the term. So we credit this term to Alice Walker, and bell hooks was also kind of in the womanist movement for a bit. A lot to this day, a lot of kind of more religiously affiliated feminists lean toward womanism. But there, to be honest with you, to this day, I wonder when people say that they are a womanist, what the difference is between womanism and Black feminism, except in name, right? For a lot of folks, the term feminism, because it has been so co-opted, that they no longer want to be associated with it, which I think that's fair, right? However, a lot of womanists are Black feminists. So when they espouse the same theoretical principles and engage in the same movements, as long as they're doing the work, I'm not really concerned with what they call themselves. I am a Black feminist. I am in a long history and genealogy of women who identify as Black feminists. And that's okay for me. So for me, it's more about the work. But mainstream white feminism really is the kind of the preemptive force that has pushed a lot of folks away from feminism, including Black feminism.
Lady, I have a question for you, and I'm going to need you to make sure the kids ain't around, and you're going to have to come in close for this one, okay? Did you know that you can squeeze, pulse, milk, lock, whip, and even twist a man in bed using only your vagina? Yes, your vagina. These and many other skills are part of a secret practice called Pompar.
Pompar is so incredibly powerful that Cleopatra was rumored to have used it to seduce Julius Caesar, the great Roman emperor, leading to the War of Alexandria. Our sponsor Goddess, that's Goddess with an H after the O, is the world's first online program teaching you all of these vaginal superpowers step by step so you can completely transform your sex life. Their program is a fully animated, structured course designed to naturally increase your pleasure, multiply your orgasms, and boost your sex drive. The Goddess program is medically backed and gets updated with new techniques and exercises every single month.
Now you know how we do. We like to test out all of our sponsors' products and services before we share them with you. And we tried the Goddess program, and girl, let me just say, I have a strong appreciation for both the content and the visuals. The engaging visuals really made it easy for me to follow along, and it kept me hooked. But one of my favorite takeaways was the emphasis on this being a lifestyle that can easily be seamlessly integrated into daily life. And that's literally how I've been using it. I'm talking about Kegels while you're washing dishes, Kegels while you're at your desk, right? Like all that good stuff. And I'm going to keep it 100. Exploring practices used by ancient escorts added a very intriguing dimension for me. And while this all might drive one's partner crazy, the neurological benefits, such as prevention of incontinence, increased pleasure, heightened libido, improved confidence, tightness, and wetness, it makes it worthwhile. I've been doing these techniques for the past few weeks, and lady, I already feel a change in my pelvic floor.
We know you want in on this program, so right now, they're offering a $100 discount on the program using the code CULTIVATE at goddess.com. That's goddess with an H after the O. GOHDDESS.com.
Okay. So I have my pen and my paper over here because we take a note. This is definitely a lesson. So thank you for teaching us and letting us sit under your tutelage. This is very, very informative. And at the same time, Jen, we want to shift up the energy a little bit.
So yeah.
We'll shift it up a little bit and we'll hop back into more of this conversation. But because we recognize, appreciate, and celebrate the multifaceted woman, and we believe that it's okay to be bougie, classy, and ratchet, okay? Yeah. You can still be elegant and dance to strip club music if you so choose. Yes. So we want to invite you to the OU Blatchet segment. Do you take on the challenge?
I'm ready. Okay. Kind of sure.
Okay. You're ready? Okay. Sure.
I think so. Nervous.
So, now that we got you. Okay, dope. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask you three questions. We're going to share three sentence completions. And then we're going to have, we have three photos pulled up of you that we found online. And we want you to choose a number out of one and three. And when we show you the photo, we want you to, one, describe the photo for folks that are only listening to the audio. And then we want you to give some more context about the photo that we would not know just by looking at the photo.
All right.
So let's jump on it. It's okay, Jen. We got you. We're going to ease into the segment. So I'm going to ask you softball. This first question is, what's the best piece of wisdom or advice you've ever received?
The best piece of wisdom or advice I ever received was from my grandmother. I was 11 years old. This is in the introduction of the book. She told me, she said, women like us, we spend a lot of time alone. You're going to be very lonely. She says, so you find the people who love you and you love them back. That's one of the best things I've ever received. It was a little too early. I feel like it was a little too early, but I've never forgotten it.
That is beautiful. The wisdom from grandma, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how grandma would respond to hearing this next question.
Oh, your she was fine. Don't worry about it.
All right. So, Dr. Jen.
Yes.
Are you going to twerk or two-step?
You mean like right now or in general?
I mean, it could be right now, but in general.
Oh, I'm a twerker. I'm a twerk girl. Yeah, I'm a twerk girl.
Yes.
Hey, that's what we love to hear.
Yeah.
So our last question for this segment is, what's the sexiest item you own?
Oh y'all, I'm filthy. You asking the wrong person.
Yes, we love
filthy. We're ready for it. We're here for it. Yes,
I am an androgynous gender flux individual who is a fool. Shoot, I'm gonna keep it as PG as possible because it can get real. You know, I was trying to be real fancy a few years ago. I was like, I'm gonna go to Fifth Avenue and go shopping for my boo thing. And I got this like strangling. It was like, it's like a lot of strength. And I never wore it because I already dumped her. So she never even saw it. So now I got to get a new boo so I can wear it. It's cute. So she ain't never seen it. So we're going to have to, I got to get a new boo.
That's right. Get a new boo. Get a new boo for it.
Yes.
Strings and that little rhinestone from the strings.
Yes. Oh, okay. So, yes. Somebody got to see cute. It.
Someone needs to see it.
Yes.
Someone needs to see it. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's the one.
All right. So now on to our sentence completion. One question or topic I wish people asked me about more often is...
I wish people asked me about, like, nerdy things, like maths. You know, like, I know that sounds weird, but people always want to pick my brain about the same stuff. And I'm like, I got range. Like, I love talking about algebra. Like, I wish somebody would just walk up and be like, 2x equals 6 minus 17. I'm like, let's do it. Let's solve that right now. I would love that. It would be a great experience for me.
Wow, that is so wild. You're not going to believe this, Jen, because one, I'm not a math person, so I admire the fact that you are. And I'm like, I wish I had that. I have to build on that. But the sentence completion that we have for you, you're not going to believe this. It's what I would tell you about math and algebra is.
Oh, really? Oh, this is for me. Oh, okay. I have one. Can I tell y'all something? Okay. So I used to teach statistics. And it's really important. So, and it's important that folks understand statistics so they can kind of do things like linear regressions. And I used to teach people how to do, I'm not finishing the sentence like I'm supposed to. No, you're good.
This is good.
Okay.
This is good.
So I used to teach people like introductory work in like political science. They can like build their models. And people are very afraid of this one type of model called a linear regression model. And it's actually quite simple, right? It's you're just fitting a line to a set of behaviors. And when you look at it on a page, right, it's scary. It's all these dots and you got to fit a line. But when you think about it in a theoretical sense of what you're doing, it makes a lot of sense. So I would tell them, you know, you're doing linear regressions all the time. You're doing predictions all the time. When you look out the window in the morning and you're thinking about the weather, and then you're thinking about what you're going to wear based on what you think the weather's going to do, you're making predictions. You're also using history, right? So you're taking previous predictions and you're fitting a line, right? A trend line. If you get sick today, your stomach hurts. What are you going to think about? You're going to think about what you did yesterday, what you ate, your behaviors. You're regressing a line, right? And so when I started, yeah, see that thing you just did?
Oh my gosh.
They always do that. Every time it's like, right? It's, you're doing it. You just don't realize that you're doing it, right? We always are taking in information and we're using our historical knowledge and the trends that we've already seen. And we're fitting a line to make decisions. That's all we're doing.
I've had the wrong math teachers all this time is basically what I'm learning here. Like, I needed a dope math teacher like you. Come on.
Like, that's where were you when I was taking statistics in grad school?
Exactly. Come on, Jen.
We I was probably in school too. Yeah, right.
Probably. Yep. Okay, so our final sentence completion. What I love most about myself is...
You know what? What I love most about myself is my deep joy and fire for life. Like I've had a tough life. I've been through a lot. I'm looking at 40 this year. And I was telling my spouse this yesterday. I've worked really hard to survive and to stay alive, you know? And because of that, I just, every day I wake up and I'm so excited. You know, I'm so excited to be here and I'm so excited for my purpose and my work. Like, I'm so excited to be walking in my purpose. So I love that about myself, that I really am stepping into who I'm supposed to be and I'm enjoying it.
Good for you. And we love to see it. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Talking about or speaking of seeing things, we have some photos for that. Pictures that what photos you got.
I want to see now.
So what's your number out of 1 and 3?
3.
3. Okay, that's good. 3. Oh, this is fun. Okay. The hair. Okay, let me just go to the picture. So, Jen, if you can describe the photo first, and then if you can share some context about the photo with the peoples.
Okay.
Okay, there we go.
Okay. This is I'm wearing a black top. I've got my long twists that I put in last year. I had some juicy twists and my flower crown. And I'm holding the book, Tony K. Bambara's The Salt Eaters. So the context for this book is that for the last 2 to 3 years, I've run a Black feminist book club online so that folks, you know, can build their repertoire. I was writing lecture notes and just kind of having this virtual experience so folks could like really learn. And this was one of our books at the very end of the series last year.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for sharing with us. That is amazing. Okay. And this is on Patreon. We're going to learn more about this later. But I'm like, how can I sign up to be sitting under Dr. Jen so I can learn some stuff? Okay. So this is good. Thank you.
Absolutely.
This was fun. Thank you for participating in this segment with us. We're going to jump back into some of these other juicy questions. But maybe one thing we can dive into as we transition back is, can you talk a bit about like some of the misconceptions with Black feminism? Because I know growing up, I feel like for me, my first introduction to feminism was like, it was a white woman thing. And then it was like, feminism is like an anti-Black male thing. So it's like, it was so interesting trying to wrap my head around it initially. So can you talk to us about the misconceptions?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best way to sum that up is like, you know, I start, for instance, my book, I start off talking about my mother. My mother, she's still here. She's with us. She is a singer. And my family, they're all singers. And they used to have this singing group called Majesty. And they would sing at our house because we had the piano. So every Wednesday night, they would come over and they would sing, you know, for hours. And I talk about this in the book because these were some of the first Black feminist teachers I ever had, right? My Auntie Barbara was I love my Auntie Barbara. She passed away during the COVID peak of 2020 to 2021. And when I was a little girl, I used to try and cook for my aunts when they would come over for the Majesty rehearsal. And I would try out new things. So one night I tried to make chicken and I had no idea what I was doing. But it was raw in the middle. And she was like, Cynthia, my mom never said, Cynthia, this chicken is raw. But she said, you know, it's okay, baby. She said, next time you make that chicken, you just poke it with a fork and you make sure that no red comes out. It come out clear, you know it's good. She said, but the season is chicken. The chicken is seasoned perfect, you know? And I always hear my Auntie Barbara now, right? When I make chicken, every time I poke that chicken, I hear my Auntie Barbara, you know? And those same nights, you know, my Auntie Donna Faye always told me, whenever you wear lipstick, you put on some earrings. You know, she would just tell me these little things. And that's the same lesson I got from my grandmother. Women like us will be alone, you know, so if you find people who love you, love them back. So Black feminism isn't just this, you know, scholarly, academic, intellectual endeavor that happens at these universities in these elite classrooms, right? Black feminism is actually the ways that we teach each other to survive, right? That's what we're doing. When we keep Black children alive against a world and institutions that want them annihilated, that is Black feminism, right? When we nurture new generations at our churches, at our organizations, at our jobs, in our communities, in our households, that is Black feminism. Our choice to live and to live freely and away from the white gaze and to be fully in our bodies and to say, no, you don't get to take all of this. This is for me. That is Black feminism. So I really want folks to stop thinking that it's about anybody else. It couldn't possibly be about Black men because it's not for them. It's for us. It couldn't possibly be about white women because this whole book, they're not even in there. Like, white women have been walking out of my book tour talks. And I'm like, bye, Karen. It wasn't for you anyway, right? Like, it's for us. That's what Black feminism is. It's a way for us to understand that we belong here. We deserve to live, to breathe. And we deserve to do that without having to carry all this ailment and sickness in our body because other people want to extract our energy, right? We deserve to be full.
Oh, okay. Lady, if you are not watching this interview, you need to because, oh my gosh. Oh, okay. So Dr. Jen, you have referenced your book multiple times in this interview. So Let's dig in.
Okay.
The title.
Yes.
Black Women Taught Us. Like, and I love what you pointed out that the book is for us. And it's all Black women.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about the book and your process and your why in creating this book.
Yeah. I mean, it's linked to my origin story, right? You know, when I was looking for, you know, something to help me understand what I was experiencing in the world, I didn't find it on my college campus. There was no Black feminist political thought class taught at USC in 2002 to 2006. There was no professor to teach it. I searched, and I could not find anything. And this book comes out of that desperation, right, of being that young person and searching for reflections of myself and not being able to find them. You know, I was lucky that a few years later, it wasn't really a few, it was more like a decade later, right? We saw the huge kind of growth of social media. So all of these Black feminists were now online. We had Gradient Lair, we had Crump Feminist Collective, we had Racialicious. We had all these folks writing now for blogs, and you could just go read these things for free, right? But when I was growing up, that didn't exist. And a lot of these Black women's works were out of print when I was looking for them, you know? So Black Women Taught Us is a set of love letters, really, to the Black women who I discovered on my Black feminist journey, right? That's why I start with my mother and my aunts and my grandmothers, right? I walk through, you know, my Black feminist journey from childhood all the way through to today to explain that Black women are always teaching us, and they are often teaching us at great risk to themselves, right? I talk about Harriet Jacobs. I talk about Ida B. Wells, who we know was run out of her city because she told the truth about lynching. I talk about Zora Neale Hurston, who died of malnutrition in 1960. And if not for Alice Walker's efforts, we would have not had even had access to her work. I talk about Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer was only 60 years old when she died. And when she died, they said she was a housekeeper. And there's nothing wrong with being a housekeeper. She just wasn't. She was Fannie Lou Hamer, you know? I talk about Shirley Chisholm's life. I talk about Audre Lorde. And I spend a lot of time talking about Toni Morrison as a horror writer because she wrote about Black trauma. I talk about the Combahee River Collective, Angela Davis. And I close the book discussing bell hooks. So these are the folks on my journey, right? And the book is meant to take you on that journey. But these are not the only Black women in the book, right? So when I discuss the erasure of Black women's labor, I also mention Marsha P. Johnson, who was killed, and we still don't know the conditions of her death. Meanwhile, she was critical to the Stonewall Rebellion, and white men were largely given credit for that and for Pride as we know it today. You know what I'm saying? So the whole book is really trying to push us to understand that these Black women have been doing this labor for us. And it may be the Black woman who keeps giving us candy at church, right? It may be our mom. It may be the Fannie Lou Hamers and the bell hookses, right? But they are always pouring into us. They're always teaching us. And we just need to listen and we need to do the work.
Oh, just thank you again, Jen, for just what the work that you do, but also who you represent. And I think about legacy and how, you know, when those stories stop being told, the next generation mm-hmm. won't be able to, they won't know. You know, I think about all of our legacies as we're here on this, you know, on this podcast. And I think about, I mean, 20, 30, 40 years from now, like hopefully someone's there to tell our story so people can know like this person existed. So I just think about how powerful it must be, how powerful it is for you to be able to compile those stories and reintroduce people if they haven't been introduced to them. So thank you for that. And I wanted to also ask you about energy. You kind of spoke about our energy and our gifts and protecting them. So I'd love to know from your perspective, from your work, from your life experience, in what ways do people, I want to say other non-Black people, but it could be anyone, how do they try to siphon our energy? And what are the ways in which you protect your energy now, who you are today?
China. This is why I'm so grateful I'm a Black feminist, because I think, you know, they taught me, you know. I talked earlier about Toni Morrison's radical refusal, but Audre Lorde also is a model for this. You know, in the book, I talk about her focus on self-care as a form of comradeship, right? And part of the reason why this is important in the book is because people associate Audre Lorde with self-care because they pull out one quote of hers where she talks about self-care being a part of a revolution. But what they don't focus on is the part before it, where she's discussing her relationship to her cancer diagnoses. Folks don't realize that much of Audre Lorde's self-care work stems from her facing her own mortality and her kind of thinking about end of life and the fact that she had given so much to these movements and to these folks who were not pouring back into her, right? I got a glimpse of this the other day. I was watching an interview with Alice Walker, and Alice Walker has largely removed herself from the limelight. Now, granted, some of that is because Alice Walker got some shitty politics and some stuff, right? We know that. Alice Walker has given us some beautiful things, but she also needs to shut the hell up on some other things. That's true, right?
Air. Yep.
But yes. But also, what she said, which I thought was important, was that she had to remove herself because she had a stroke. And that her stroke was related to the labor she was doing, advocating for these communities. And it was just draining her. And it was so resonant for me from all the stories I had written in this book, because these women were dying so young, of largely preventable ailments, things that they should have been able to be treated for if they had community, if they had people who were looking after them, if they had scaffolding. So to answer your question, I learned this from these women, from reading Black feminism, from watching my mother, from watching my grandmother, and sadly watching some of these women pass away. I watched a lot of my aunts pass away during the COVID-19 crisis. I watched a lot of them struggle for many, many years. And what I've taken from that is that if we don't commit to establishing and fiercely defending our boundaries, if we don't put our feet down and stand forthright against people, even people who look like us, even people who say they love us, who ask us to break and to bend and to be flexible and just to give a little bit more, we will find ourselves giving and giving and giving and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and no longer being who we are and no longer having anything left for ourselves. And I'm saying that from experience. I'm saying that because I've done it and I have to work actively not to do it, because the world expects us to be superhuman. The world thinks that we are our resources to be tapped that have no limitation whatsoever. And it's when we fall into that cycle with it, right, that we see ourselves weathering. This is what Arlene Geronimus talks about with the weathering hypothesis, right? People always say Black women, oh, Black don't crack because we look good. But that's because we're aging from the inside out, not from the outside in. You see what I'm saying? So for me, I am in a radical state of refusal. I'm not coming. Hey, y'all, no thanks. And I'll tell people from the beginning, I don't have FOMO. I'm not interested. Y'all have fun. You can go ahead and gloat. I don't give a shit. I love my couch. I got snacks. I got blankets. I got people here who like me. All the food in my house is good. I'm not coming outside. There's things I'm not finna do. I don't care about time no more. Brittany Cooper said time is white supremacist. I believe her. Like, it's some things I'm not finna do. And it's not to be rude. It's not to be nasty. It's so that I can survive. It is an act of self-preservation. And I'm not allowing anybody else to kill me.
Oh.
Zora said it.
Mic drop.
Ooh. Zora said it. She said, if you are silent about your pain, they will kill you and they will say you enjoyed it.
Mm-mm.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Ooh.
And we not over here for that. We not signing up for that.
Mm-mm.
All right. So if you are in a radical state of refusal, that look like? Because like, I know that we're going to have some listeners that are going to listen to this and they're going to say, well, my life is not set up like that.
Sure.
I don't have that privilege to engage in radical refusal.
Mm-hmm.
But we all do to some extent. There are areas in our lives where we can.
Mm-hmm.
So break it down for the people.
That's right.
What does that look like?
So for me, you know, I will admit, yes, I am in a privileged position now. I'm a professor at an elite university. I have a little bit of power. There are things I can say no to, right? But what I also will posit here is that even when I was a graduate student who had to eat ramen, okay, there was still some boundaries that I upheld because I was willing to take the consequences, which is if people have a problem with me, if they don't want to hang out with me because I took care of myself, because I don't want to be physically sick and ailed, because they need me to show up and perform niceness and networking or whatever it might be, I am okay with that, right? If you move in your integrity, a radical state of refusal doesn't mean put yourself at economic risk, take yourself out of situations that are good for you. It means limit your access to people or things that are harmful, that are extractive, that are not reciprocal, right? And the problem is that we're so nervous about people doing something to hurt us that we're not thinking that doing the thing is going to hurt us. You see what I'm saying? So for me, even when I was a graduate student, even before I was a graduate student, I really started to interrogate the things I was doing out of obligation. When I felt like I have to do that. If I don't do that, what's going to happen, right? Because unfortunately for Black women, we are socialized that almost everything for everyone else is an obligation. We got to go out and act a certain way for the people and the men in our lives. Our children require that we show up in certain ways. Otherwise, people are going to say that we're a bad parent, right? The standards on us are different than they are for everybody else. That's the refusal I'm talking about. I stopped caring about the naming and the ways that people were thinking about what I was doing. I don't care what they think because I know who I am. I know how my family operates. I know who my children are. And eventually, this is what I always tell people, eventually people leave you to hell alone because it's a relearning process. Refusal is not a process of constant agitation, right? You are teaching people how to treat you. You have to model the behavior so people know how to treat you. That's what refusal is.
These are the episodes that make me so grateful for this platform that we have and being able to have an opportunity to speak to people like you, because if that wasn't a word, I could not wait to re-listen to this episode. And I just want to add, I'm so glad you talked about energy and you talked about the radical state of refusal, because there, once upon a time, more recently than I've stayed, I would be flattered when people would say, like, oh, you have such good energy. Oh, I want to hang around you. And it's like, oh, cool, people like me. And then I was like, wait, they don't, just because they realize the light don't mean they get access to it. So
that's right.
I appreciate you breaking that down because that's so important. Like, yeah, you do have good energy. Yeah, I do have good energy. That don't mean that you know what I mean? So thank you again. My question for you is, how do you act or take up space when in white spaces? I'm thinking about, we have a lot of listeners who are in predominantly white spaces, and this podcast is their space. Like, this is literally their space where they come to talk to their, you know, their homegirls, their sister friends, their aunties. Like, this is it. And so when you still have to navigate in that world and play the political games and all of that, like, what advice do you have, or how do you show up in those spaces?
I love that question. I'm going to be honest with you. I've only ever professionally been in predominantly white spaces. I've only gone to predominantly white colleges. I've only worked at predominantly white institutions. I show up just like this. I look the same in every space. I speak the same in every space. I am teaching those white folks how to treat me too. And I've done it since I was a young person, right? Or if they can't figure it out, I build a way out, right? This is the Disneyland story, right? Those folks were committed to mistreating me and misunderstanding me. There are some spaces that no matter what you do, it's the crooked room. And you're going to be sitting there, either you're going to bend yourself up or you're going to stand upright, right? And for me, I have chosen to stand upright. Now this, I will always tell people, you take a lot of a risk, right? It's dangerous, right? Because people don't like that. So you have to be strategic. If you're in a space where you can't quite stand upright yet, you figure out a way out, or you find your people in that space. You find community. I know we always talk about predominantly white spaces like they're homogenous, but they're not. I have some real good white male friends who'll be having my back in academia. They'll read my stuff. They'll help me get published. You find your people wherever they are, because this whole, you know, kinfolk, skin folk thing, all skin folk, okay? So there will be some white folk in those spaces who actually will be allies and who will have your back, right? So there's always a way to right yourself in any space. I firmly believe that we can take up space anywhere. And if you get to a point where there's no space, you should not be there, because that place is killing you. And I'm not going to give someone advice on how to stay in a space that is causing their slow death.
Can we pass around the offering plate, everyone? Let's just pass around. That is. Oh my gosh. Okay, Dom. I know we're all almost at time. I just have one last question, if that's okay. Jen, please. Yeah. So sure. When you made a powerful statement about Alice Walker earlier that we totally understood. And I just want to know, how do you take, like, just, and this is in all of our research, us as humans, how do we take the message and appreciate the gift while grappling with the shadow side of the hero or the messenger? Like, how do we do that?
Yeah. You know, I think I use the word grace a lot, but I really want to offer some context and some texture for what that means, right? You know, when we think about our elders like Alice Walker and even like a Cornel West, you know, folks who are not always on the right side, you know, what we have to understand is that generation of Black struggle has been the radical generation. I tell my students this all the time. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois, when he was writing about the Talented Tenth, that was radical. And we read it now, we're like, oh my gosh, right? You know, but when he wrote it, that was a major political statement, you know? And I want folks to understand that because it's a blessing, right, actually, that we have these folks here to be interlocutors, to be thought partners. And it is unfortunate for us when they begin to move against the right side of history, right? When they begin to advocate for stances that's like really problematic. But it does not negate the fact that without them and without their work, we would not be here, right? So for me, just like any other human being, I get to be human and so do they, right? I'm not always going to get everything right. That's part of what I write in the book too. That's what accountability is about, right? We love, this comes from Janet Mock. Years ago, when bell hooks made comments about Beyonce, Janet Mock talked about loving critically, right? Love is nothing if it's not accountable. Love has to be accountable. So someone like Alice Walker, we can love her, but she's got to be accountable to us, right? We are her community. We have to hold her accountable. So that's how we do it. We offer them grace, but we also say, hey, that's not it, right? And that's within our responsibility. And also, it's a gift for us to be able to do that, right? That's the point of community and not disposing of people, not throwing them out, right? But believing that they can be better because we believe that they are worth it, right? If we believe that Black people are valuable, that shouldn't be a hard thing to do.
Oh, I love that. Okay, that's such a beautiful way for us to wrap up the interview. And now I know that all of our listeners are going to want to know, one, where can they get your book? And two, how can they connect with you? And wait, what? There is a whole feminist book club that we could be a part of?
Like, let
the people know.
Okay, so the book, you can get the book actually anywhere books are sold. But what I'm asking folks to do is to support local Black-owned, queer-owned indie bookstores. And if you don't have one in your neighborhood, you can go onto bookshop.org and support one there. I've signed some books at stores like the Barnes & Noble on Fifth Avenue. There's a few at the Sankofa bookstore in D.C., at Loyalty Books. And there may be a few more coming up and some stops coming up. So the way you find out about new events and how to get the book from me directly or see me, you would go to jenmjackson.com. And Jen has two N's. And /books. That is the page that has all the information, the order link. I also have a syllabus for the book. So if you would like to study along with the book and by chapter read additional readings and thought questions that go along with it, you can download the Black Women Taught Us syllabus there. You can also check out all the tour dates. I'm coming to Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Detroit, and I think I'm going back to New York City and Chicago. So there's a lot of places. Find me anywhere on the internet at Jen M. Jackson, PhD. I'm all over the place. Twitter, Facebook, Threads. It's everywhere.
Thank you so much. This was incredible, Jen. We appreciate you. We wish you so much success, and we would love to keep in touch with you.
Absolutely. I'll come back anytime.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us today. Please note that our show may contain conversations about self-help, advice, self-empowerment, and mental health, but is by no means meant to be a substitute for an ongoing formal relationship with a trained mental health provider. If you or someone you know is in need of mental health care, please visit the Therapy for Black Girls Directory, Psychology Today, or contact your insurance provider.
If you liked what you heard and want to keep the conversation going, visit our website at herspacepodcast.com and be sure to click the Patreon tab to get access to video content, bonuses, and our weekly after show. And before we meet again, repeat after me. My thoughts create my reality. Today, I choose thoughts that empower and uplift me.